If you were helpful at Frankfurt, he will tell us about the review of probabilistic and discrete models for JT graph.
Okay, so thank you very much for the invitation. I'm very honored and glad to give a talk here. And so I was asked to give a review more like talk. So at least a large fraction of it will be a review. And then I will explain also new things. Some published, but also a large part that is not published yet. So here you have two papers of 2024. On which I will base part of my presentation, but as I said, the talk is mainly review and papers to appear. So that's a plan. Okay, I'm not going to go through in detail. I'll let you read the plan. We'll see if we have time to cover all these subjects. And let's start now here with Jacques Teitelbaum quantum gravity. So the defining feature of the Jacques-Teitelbaum quantum gravity is that it's a quantum gravity theory for which the bulk curvature is fixed. Okay, so it's like even in the quantum theory, you don't have any bulk curvature fluctuation. Okay, so you completely rigidify the metric in the bulk, but things can happen because you will have boundaries. So you have three models, three types of models, depending on on which curvature you choose in the bulk, positive, zero, or negative. They're all very interesting for physics. The negative curvature theory is relevant for holography, et cetera, et cetera. It's been the most studied one with some particular boundary conditions that we shall review. But the zero curvature or positive curvature are also very interesting for physics. For example, the positive curvature is relevant for cosmology, you know, De Sitter space, et cetera. The Schwarzschild description that probably you know quite well, only applies to the negative curvature model. And the study of the other models requires to go beyond the Schwarzschild description. And so this will be one of the main points of my talk, will be to go beyond the Schwarzschild description. And it's required when you have models that cannot be defined on asymptotically hyperbolic geometries or on infinite geometries. Nearly for positive curvature models, you don't have this notion of asymptotic geometry. So I start with presenting, you know, the usual action for JT gravity. The field phi, capital phi, is called the dilaton. It's really like a Lagrange multiplier field that enforces in the bulk the constraint r equal to eta. So r is the Ricci scalar. Okay. I didn't use the Gauss curvature, even though I'm in a math institute. So, okay, phi, you can think of it just as a Lagrange multiplier field. And you have a term that is proportional to the bulk area, proportional to capital lambda. You may also add boundary terms. And you may also couple this model to some matter quantum field theory, possibly a matter CFT. Of course, this action written down this way will not make much sense. On infinite geometries, it needs to be regularized. On finite geometries, the boundary terms will not make sense because we shall see that the typical metrics on the boundary are very rough, very irregular objects. So you cannot really write it this way. But that's okay. That's a starting point that is okay at the classical level. When you study JT, so you fix a curvature of the bulk, but you also have to pick boundary conditions because you will always define the model on manifolds with boundaries. And I want to emphasize that there are really three qualitatively distinct type of boundary conditions that you may want to impose. You have others, but the other boundary conditions are just obtained by doing some Laplace transform, if you like. So it's sort of trivial, but you have really three different, qualitatively different starting points. The first is something that was known as topological gravity that people actually have considered since the 80s, maybe, or the 90s. In JT, it would be like taking free boundary conditions for both the dilaton and the metric. That imposes not only that the bulk curvature is fixed, but also that the boundary extrinsic curvature is fixed. Because if the boundary conditions for the dilaton is free, you have this coupling on the boundary with little k, which is the extrinsic curvature. So if you integrate out also the boundary value of phi, it plays also the role of a Lagrange multiplier for the extrinsic curvature on the boundary. So at the end of the day, you're getting manifolds which have constant curvature in the bulk and geodesic boundaries or constant extrinsic curvature on the boundaries. This is an old story. The moduli space of matrix with such properties is just finite dimensional. It's a very interesting math story. That is not going to be my main point of emphasis today. The second type of boundary conditions are the ones that people have studied a lot, in particular in the physics literature. And for us, I will be precise and call them conformally compact boundary conditions. So those boundary conditions are only valid for the negative curvature model. And these are boundary conditions for which the boundary is actually pushed to infinity. So you constrain your space of matrix, the space of matrix that you consider to be such that any points in the bulk is actually at infinite distance from the boundary. Okay, so these are very specific sort of boundary conditions. And the third example, which is new, is when you take Dirichlet boundary conditions for the dilaton. So that's a little bit like 4.2, but free boundary conditions for the metric, which means that the boundary is going to be freely fluctuating. And that will yield models on finite size geometries for which a lot of new things will emerge compared to the second type of boundary conditions. So this third type of boundary conditions, you can think of it as the correct one to go to finite cutoff or to consider the quantum gravity, quantum JT gravity on finite size geometries. Okay, so you have really these three different types of things. Let me start. I wanted to give you, since I know this is an audience mainly of mathematicians, I wanted to give you maybe for 5 minutes or something like that, an idea of why we're interested in JT gravity. There are actually many reasons, so I could have a long list and talk for an hour just about the motivations, but I picked just one, okay? So the example I want to briefly treat is the case of Rachter-Nordström black hole in real world four-dimensional, space. We could also do Kerr. So Rachter-Nordström means a black hole that has some electric charge. Kerr would be a black hole that is rotating. So Kerr is very realistic. I mean, you have these objects in the universe pretty much everywhere. And they have similar properties, Rachter-Nordström and Kerr. So here I wrote a metric in the Euclidean, but the Minkowskian signature metric just has minus signs. The important aspects of these black holes is that they have generically two horizons, an outer horizon and an inner horizon, okay, at positions r plus and r minus, and they have a Hawking temperature and an entropy, s, which is pi r plus squared. So the area of the outer horizon is the entropy. Now, the nice thing about these guys is that you can consider a limit where the inner and the outer horizons are very, very close. So this is when the temperature goes to zero, the Hawking temperature goes to zero. In this case, a very elementary analysis shows that the near horizon geometry always contains a hyperbolic two-dimensional throat. Okay? So that's a completely universal feature of so-called near extremal black holes. So these black holes that are very low Hawking temperature. So for Rachter-Nordström in four dimensions, you have H2 cross S2. Okay? The S2 will remain finite size. It won't play a big role in what I want to say, but there is this hyperbolic throat that develops. Now, when you look at Einstein theory, in that limit, you realize that the dominating gravitational fluctuations are actually governed by the JT gravity, actually. Okay, so that object just emerges as some effective description in these near horizon limits of near extremal black holes. That's very nice. So we can use actually JT gravity to study the very low temperature limit of black hole physics. Now, this has yielded some very, sorry, yeah?
Keep in mind, where does the dilaton come from?
Okay, so the dilaton will be the mode that governs the size of the two spheres. in the from the four dimensional picture.
Why is it allowed to fluctuate freely? Almost freely.
On the boundary?
Oh, well.
Ah, in the bulk, well, it is a gravitational mode. Okay, so this size, I mean, this is so the dilaton, the leading term is the size. So that will be some constant. We will use that, if you like, as some boundary conditions. And then there is, plus some fluctuations.
But
What I call phi is the
why is there
fluctuations.
a constraint on of the dilaton, because in the JT it's just a quadratic multiplier that fluctuates
Right.
freely. Why in this 4D description this happens?
So I think, when you do the dimensional reduction from 4D to 2D, you have indeed subleading terms. If you like, the dilaton will have a potential. The linear term is what governs JT. That will be the leading term in the really T goes to zero limit. But immediately after, indeed, you have, phi squared, you have a V of phi, like, so you will have a dilaton gravity with an arbitrary potential. So this JT is really the leading term that you have, when you really go near the horizon. It's a leading approximation. But it does capture the essential gravity fluctuation, I want to emphasize now. So it's a rather, rough sort of approximation. It's really leading term, but it captures the qualitative feature that is fundamental. So the formulas that I show here, the mass and the entropy, are just, can derive that very elementarily using known techniques. So the mass or the energy of the black hole, if the temperature is not strictly zero, it starts as a T squared. The entropy grows linearly with the temperature. These two formulas have been a big puzzle for a very long time in physics for, two obvious reasons. First of all, you learn that the energy at small temperature grows like T squared, which means that if the temperature is very small, the total, if you like, thermal energy of the black hole is much smaller than something that would be linear in T, because T squared would be much smaller than T. However, a single Hawking quantum that is emitted has an energy that is of order T. That means that the whole semi-classical picture is completely breaking down here, because the emission of a single quantum carries more energy than the full, thermal energy that you have in your system. Clearly, this approximation cannot work. And that is surprising in some sense, because those black holes can be enormous. They can be like astrophysical. So the problem is not about having some strong curvature. It's something else. Okay, it's related to the fact that we have very low temperature, but okay, that's very strange. Another puzzle is that, of course, the entropy at zero temperature is also a huge number, non-zero, because for the extra, even at the extremal limit, you have this huge horizon. So we are not used. I mean, it's very strange to have in quantum mechanics a system that is sort of generic. By generic, I mean there's no supersymmetry in those systems, and that would have a macroscopic degeneracy for the ground state. That is extremely bizarre. How do you build that? We know how to build that in supersymmetric examples, because supersymmetry allows you to have that these sort of degeneracies. But in a non-supersymmetric setup, this is really strange. Okay. So these were, two basic problems in this, two basic puzzles for these near extremal black holes. Now, JT gravity gave the clue how to solve that. And the remarkable, truly remarkable thing is to realize that even though those black holes, again, are very large, there is no problem with the curvature. The curvature can be arbitrarily small. In spite of this, there is one mode in the gravitational fluctuations that is not tamed, that is not semi-classical, that strongly fluctuates. And this large mode is this famous, by now, JT gravity reparametrization that needs to be treated fully quantum mechanically, in spite, again, of the fact that the black hole is very large. When you do this, so it's really quantum gravity, to my knowledge, it's the first application of quantum gravity to something that looks like the real world. We found a particular instance where a strong quantum gravity fluctuation is actually fundamental to understand the physics and not related to Planck scale or height curvature. Okay. So when you do this, okay, we know how to deal with JT, and the puzzles are solved. Like the energy now has at very low temperature a term that is proportional to T. So that really comes from the quantum fluctuations of this JT gravity mode. And the entropy gets a log T term, log T correction, which of course when T goes to zero no longer makes any sense, but it's associated with the density of state. And we now understand that this is, if you like, some signal of a discrete spectrum at very low energy. And this approximation only gives the continuous limit of the spectrum, but there will really be a discrete spectrum, which means that the huge degeneracy that you believe the Hawking-Bekenstein formula computes is not really a degeneracy of the ground state. It's just the density of state that is very large, very near the ground state. So you have a huge number of states near the ground states, but they are discrete, actually. Okay, and the ground state probably is unique. So if you go to very, very, very strictly zero temperature, the entropy will go to zero, actually, in those systems. All right. Any question about this? So that just to give you, you know, one of the reasons why we've been excited about JT. Okay, good. Now let me review the Schwarzian field theory. Okay, so the Schwarzian field theory is can be completely well defined probabilistically. I mean, and there's been beautiful work by Belokurov and Jabulidze, and then made much more precise and elegant by Bauer, Schmidt et al., where we understand completely what the Schwarzian field theory is, you know, even at the level of probability and mathematical rigor. The path integral is, as I indicated, so you integrate over circle diffeomorphisms F. DLF is this formal left invariant measure on the group of circle diffeomorphisms that, of course, does not exist, but we write it anyway. And SCH is this Schwarzian action. And the dots represent possible insertions that you may want to include in your path integral. For instance, insertions of these operators OH, which are PSL2R invariant bilocal operators that geometrically will compute the normalized lengths of geodesics in your geometry. So this is the objects that defines the Schwarzian field theory. Yes? Well, I mean, so the measure is infinite because you have this PSL2R invariance. So this is a formal, you know, division. You have to fix the gauge. Okay, so you have to do a slice. It's the usual. Physics, we call that the Fadeyev-Popov procedure. So that's a trivial thing. Otherwise, you have to think that this measure factorizes into an infinite piece. And yeah. All right. So the precise definition of the measure is actually very simple. You just write down that the derivative of your diffeomorphisms is proportional to exponential of Q, where Q is a completely standard Brownian process. Okay, or Euclidean quantum particle, as you would say in physics. And the measure, so now the well-defined measure, which combines the formal DLF with some piece of the Schwarzian action, is just the Wiener measure. So at the fundamental level, the Schwarzian field theory is just the Wiener measure plus some additional terms that modify the measure. But it's like a Radon-Nikodym derivative, if you like what you add. At the fundamental level, everything is defined just by the Wiener process. Okay, so it's a very simple thing. Yes?
Well, mathematician, it's a bit sharp because of the equation. So the right-hand side is totally fine, but you said it's equal to the left. So how do we know that the measure is the right one?
So how do we know? So first of all, it has all the required properties. So in particular, the PSL2R invariance, and it transforms in some particular way under left multiplications, which is what we want. So you could say, okay, it satisfies the list of axioms. That is what physicists would like. And then it's a precise mathematical object. On the other hand, maybe you would like to have a derivation from JT. And I will give a hint of how this is done in the next few minutes. I won't have time to do a full thing, but yeah.
Very clever.
So, you know, the important thing here is to realize that F is a smooth, completely smooth object. Okay, F prime is continuous, almost surely. So F is like C1. You know? So it's the Schwarzschild field theory really deals with the smooth guys, the nice smooth guys. Okay, so maybe to answer your question in more detail, so because when you look at the Schwarzschild field theory, why is this a theory of quantum gravity? You know, well, you could say, what is the relation with JT gravity? So let me give you some idea of the relation. It might be completely mysterious. So when you have a quantum gravity model, in all cases, if you want to have, let's say, a first principle approach, you have to choose two things. The first thing is the space of matrix that you allow, if you like, the space over which you will integrate with the path integral. So this is sometimes, this choice is sometimes referred to as the choice of boundary conditions, but more generally, if you want to be more precise, it's really a choice of the space of matrix that is supposed to be relevant or allowed for the model you want to consider. And then you also have to choose a gauge group, which is, and which are the matrix that you will identify. Okay, and so this is a group of diffeomorphisms, but when you have boundaries, you have many groups of diffeomorphisms that you may want to consider. So you also have to be careful here. And then after you've done that, appropriate choices will yield the Schwarzschild description. So how does that work? So this is the precise setup. You consider, so let's say you have a manifold M with one boundary. You could have many boundaries, you focus on one, that's where you're going to impose the boundary conditions that will yield the Schwarzschild. You consider matrix by definition that must be conformally compact. So you have, they take this form G bar A over A squared, where A is a defining function. You have a similar formula for the dilaton. So the G bar A extends smoothly to the boundary. As usual, so HA will be the induced metric on the boundary of G bar A. And since you also have this dilaton, you have a ratio phi A divided by the square root of the induced metric on the boundary, which can be fixed because this is an object that is independent of the choice of your defining function. And you also impose that the curvature R will be minus two, so negative curvature plus corrections that must be of order A squared. For us, this last condition will not deal with it much longer because we will integrate out the dilaton and impose r equal minus two as an exact equation eventually. So that's the first set of conditions I put on my matrix. Okay, so that's really conformally compact matrix. These are the boundary conditions that we always use in holographic setups, even in higher dimensions. Okay, so there is no thing too special here. In higher dimensions, you have similar, very similar sort of conditions. Then the choice of the gauge group. The choice of the gauge group, and that's crucial, it needs to be only the small diffeos, what I call here diff of M S1, which means the diffeomorphisms that act trivially on the boundary. You do not gauge the boundary reparametrizations. This is also a crucial feature of any holographic theory. When you have an asymptotic boundary, you pretend that the boundary coordinates are sort of fundamental. So there is a boundary observer, okay? And this is why on the boundary in holography, the theory does not gravitate. Okay? The boundary theory is not gravity. So the coordinates are fixed on the boundary and you will not gauge boundary reparametrizations. That's good. So that's the second point. Third point that you also need in order to make sense of your model is you have to add data. So I said that we were having this boundary coordinate for a theta that is fundamental. Actually, you endow, you know, your manifold with some Collard structure. So you have some privilege r theta coordinates near the boundary. R equal to zero is let's say the location of the boundary, and you have a boundary a metric that you pick. That's a data in the definition of your model. Okay, so you need this data to define a holographic model, a Collard structure and a particular metric on the boundary that you fix. So data in your problem. With all this, we're going to be able to define very rigorously what we mean by this Schwarzschild theory. First of all, the space of metrics, so now takes the form that I have indicated. So it's the quotient of the space of conformally compact hyperbolic matrix. Now hyperbolic because, okay, I know that eventually in JT r equal minus 2. So I impose that they are conformally compact and r equal minus 2, quotiented by the group of small d theos. You can compute that moduli space, this moduli space, and it's the well-known coadjoint orbit, if you like, of Virasoro, the quotient of the diffeomorphism of the circle by PSL2R. This really comes from the fact that if you had gauged the large DFAOs, you could go to conformal gauge. But there's only one conformal complete metric, if you like, or conformally compact metric. So any elements in this moduli space can be obtained by applying a large DFAO on this unique guy, which is, of course, the Poincaré metric on the disk, which has some PSL2R isometry, so the little group is PSL2R, and that explains why you have this formula. Okay, so there is no mystery here about this computation of the moduli space. Another element, another piece of information that is important to know, is that in any orbit in this quotient space, you can always find a unique element that has the so-called Fefferman-Gram form. Okay, so you can write it in this way in the Kolar r theta coordinates we've picked. So, you know, it's a very simple formula. EB is the data we have fixed, and E2 is actually the function that encodes all the freedom in your metric. Okay, so these metrics are super constrained. I mean, everything is in a unique function, E2 of theta, that will take some particular form. All right. Now you can check that large DFAOs will act on E2. If you act with a large DFAO on G hat, it will act on E2. And the action is exactly the coadjoint action of Virasoro. Okay, so that's a nice calculation to make. Okay, so the large DFAOs act on E2 as the coadjoint coadjoint action of Virasoro. And essentially with this, we have everything that we need. So yes?
So this corresponds, like what's the minimal regularity for this to make sense?
For what? Like, so all this is completely regular. So all these metrics are like completely smooth.
Yeah, but when I say like say that the regularity of the Schwarzian measure, so the right hand side is kind of like C1.5 minus epsilon. Does this still?
It's okay. As I said, it's at the end of the day, it's a Wiener process. So you know, it's exactly like of course when we write the Schwarzian action, you have second derivatives. In the same way as when you write, I don't know, the free particle action, you have Q dot squared. We know that this, you know, almost surely does not exist, but that defines the measure. Then that's what I mean at this moment.
I mean, kind of the, can you actually write down the metric? Like if I give you the measure, which was in theory, can you write down this?
So you want to resolve this form. Maybe you want the relation between E2 and F on the circle diffeomorphism. That I will give now, in 1 minute. Then you'll see the relation with the Schwarzian. Here, I'm not at the Schwarzian field theory yet, almost, but not completely. All right. So with all this data, the important thing is that you can define a renormalized action, which is, you know, like the renormalized volumes that you know very well in hyperbolic space. Here is some sort of renormalized volume, but the volume is replaced by the JT action. So you have a renormalized JT action, which is defined by regularizing your manifold. You replace your manifold by some M epsilon, which is cut off at this particular coordinate R equal epsilon. Okay, so you remove the what is very near the boundary, and then you take the epsilon goes to limit, to zero limit of the JT gravity action evaluated on the G hat, you know, on this unique element in the orbit that had the Fefferman-Gram form. And that defines the model. That defines the action. Very little calculation shows this formula, just the integral of the boundary value of the dilaton E2 d theta. And to get the Schwarzian theory, you just have to now realize that E2 is going to be the Schwarzian derivative of F, but that's not difficult to see. If you're on a disk, okay, let's assume we're on a disk topology, then E2 has to satisfy constraints because the holonomy of this matrix must be trivial. That tells you that the relevant orbit of the Virasoro, of the quadrant, relevant quadrant orbit of Virasoro, is the one that contains the constant one quarter. Okay, that's a non-trivial exercise, very interesting to make, that you know you realize that for metrics that have trivial holonomies, there's only one quadrant orbit that can do that, and that's this constant one quarter orbit. You add with Virasoro, you do the quadrant action of Virasoro on this constant minus one quarter, and you get E2 equal minus one half of the Schwarzschild derivative of the tangent of F over 2. And that's exactly the Schwarzschild action. Okay, so this is how you derive from JT the Schwarzschild field theory in these particular boundary conditions, which restrict enormously the set of metrics that you're allowed to consider, of course. They're entirely parametrized by these circle diffeomorphisms. You can make the link with what is known in the physics literature as the smoothly wiggling boundary configurations by realizing that if you look at the finite geometries that you obtain by cutting off at r equal epsilon, then you have indeed, because it's cut off, not the geometry as finite size. Any constant curvature metric of finite size can be represented as an immersion in hyperbolic space. And this immersion will be this smoothly wiggling disk. And you can check that the F that I have been talking about here is exactly the F that you find in the physics literature introduced by hand-waving and probably incomprehensible arguments, even by a lot of physicists. But that's exactly the same object. So we are matching everything, but here I gave you the, I think, the right, the rigorous presentation of it.
Okay. The beta S, is it completely free or is it fixed by matter?
The what?
Beta S.
So the beta S is completely fixed. So that's a parameter. It's an arbitrary parameter.
It's not fixed by the interaction with matter also.
No. It's an arbitrary parameter that you can have in your model. And, you know, beta S, the important thing is that because it is arbitrary, it's a number of order one, this action is not to be treated semi-classical. The semi-classical limit would be beta S goes to zero, some sort of very high temperature limit. But we don't want to do that. The mode is not going to be weakly coupled or semi-classical. Beta S is of order one, and you have to treat that model non-perturbatively.
How do you fix it in physics?
So it will be related to the temperature. And we'll interpret it as the temperature. All right. Now, if I had more time, I would explain how you derive the measure, this formal left invariant measure that would require to use some Fadeyev Popov procedure in a setup where you only gauge the small diffeomorphisms. There's a lot of interesting technical issues associated with that, but I don't have time to talk about it. In private, if some of you are interested, I can give you some text, but I won't have time here.
So if you, in JT, you couple with matter, mm-hmm. how does it affect this?
No, it does not affect at all. So you will have to add the matter action that will be coupled to the metric, which is parametrized by F, exactly the way I explained. Okay, so the matter will be coupled to gravity. Via metrics that are very, very specific, parametrized by F. So you have a coupling, if you like, of your matter action to this circle diffeo, which is very explicit.
But it doesn't affect the law.
It doesn't affect everything I said here. Because what I said, if you like, is the JT action piece and the measure also will be treated. If you add the term in the action, it will not be affected. It will not affect the discussion.
I mean, the beta is.
Beta can still be chosen arbitrarily. Yeah. This one is not related to the matter. What time is it? Because I don't have time here and I don't see any clock.
10:05.
05?
Yeah.
Okay. Now I want to go to the story of finite geometries. Okay. The first thing to realize is that the space of metrics for finite size
geometries in JT
will be much, much larger than the space of conformally compact matrix that we've just discussed and that are relevant for the Schwarzschild model. And that will imply that the physics will be completely different. So something I've already said quickly, it's quite nice to represent the matrix to realize that at least if you have matrix on the disk of constant curvature, you can always represent them as in an isometric way as immersed disk in some canonical target space. And the canonical target space you choose according to the curvature of the model you study. So if you want to do flat JT, you just immerse your disk into a Euclidean space or hyperbolic or the two sphere if you have curved models. So this is why I can present you this sort of pictures. So all these pictures represent finite size constant curvature matrix that have to be included in the path integral if you want to consider JT on finite size geometries. On top of the smoothly wiggling guys, you have the, let's say, self-avoiding guys with a lot of zigzags, but you also have overlapping configurations. These are perfectly good because they are immersed disks. And you also have boundaries that can take the shapes of the inset, the lower insets in the figure, that looks extremely complicated. So all these configurations are included. In parentheses, they're included even when these configurations, let's say, are very large. The boundary of these guys can be arbitrarily large. Okay, so that's a parenthesis because in physics, sometimes they present the Schwarzschild model, not in terms of conformally compact metrics, but in terms just of metrics that have very large, very long boundaries. That's completely wrong. I mean, these guys, super complicated guys, can have arbitrarily large boundaries, but they won't be conformally compact in the limit where they become infinitely large. Okay, so, but they have to be included in the finite geometry models. All right? There is, on top of these complications, an absolutely remarkable phenomenon. If you've never seen that, you will be surprised. It's called the Milner phenomenon because, I mean, the legend says that it's Milner that first wrote this curve. So the Milner curve is this one. This one, I represent it like in a sort of Darth Vader sort of figure. And this curve has the amazing property that it actually is the boundary of two distinct disks. So you can fill it up inside with two distinct disks. By distinct, I mean that the metric that corresponds to the filling will be diffeomorphism in equivalent. So a given boundary can bound many disks. And here I tried, you know, to represent it by separating the disk into pieces that are bounded by simple curves so that you clearly see how it works. And then you merge, you glue those different pieces and you reproduce two distinct disks, but the boundary curve will be the same in both examples. Okay, so that's really remarkable. The example here, the one on the lower right side of the slide, a more complicated one, there are three disks, three distinct disks in that guy. You can try to work it out, okay? And you can have configurations with an arbitrary large number of disks inside. So that's a remarkable thing that tells you that one of the law of JT gravity, you know, that the dynamics is governed by fluctuating boundaries is wrong, actually, on finite geometry. It's correct for this conformally compact matrix, but for finite size matrix, it's not correct. The boundary does not encode the degrees of freedom. You have to associate with the boundaries a multiplicity that counts the number of disks inside. And it will turn out that this will be the typical configurations. The typical configurations have a non-zero, a non-trivial multiplicity. Okay? So this looks horribly complicated, and you know, you can, there's even another layer of complication because you could say, okay, but maybe, okay, there's this multiplicity, but maybe at least any curve, any closed loop bounds on disk. That's not true. So some closed loops have multiplicity zero, if you like. They're not allowed. Okay. So the set of closed loops that bound disks are called self-overlapping. And those self-overlapping guys come with some multiplicity. And that's what you have to deal with. So here, for example, these two simple examples on the lower center and lower right-hand side are forbidden. There is no disk in those simple things. Okay, you can. All right, so how are we going to deal with this? At least, maybe it looks complicated, but at least there is a way to go to define rigorously the model, because clearly this can be discretized. So let's say we're looking at the flat jetty gravity. Discretize, take some square lattice or any regular tessellation of the plane, but let's do with square lattice, and consider a model of random self-overlapping polygons that you count with the multiplicity I was talking about. That is the same as counting the flat disk matrix uniform. That's a combinatorial problem. Very similar to the way UV gravity is formulated by considering triangularizations. Here, these are triangularizations or quadrangulations with the constraint that the bulk curvature is zero. So I have a constraint both on the degree of the vertices and the length of the faces. That makes the model more complicated because it's constrained. The boundary has no constraint, but inside you have this constraint. You can formulate this in terms of a matrix model, a la DiFrancesco and Isikson, called like these dually weighted graphs. You know, DiFrancesco and Isikson considered that a long time ago. You can consider matrix models where you weight arbitrarily the degrees of the vertices and the length of the faces. And this is an instance, of course, where you will freeze the degrees to be four and the length of the faces to be four as well. So it's a complicated matrix model. Techniques have been developed to deal with those matrix models by Kazakov and collaborators in the late 90s, but they didn't push it enough to immediately solve what we need. But it exists. This formulation exists. That's an open problem, but it exists in terms of a matrix model. All right. So we have started to work on this. You can have fun proving some simple things, but these simple things are not so easy to prove, even the very simple things. So for example, the total number of configurations as a function of the boundary length that I call n, you can prove that it grows exponentially with n. There's a connective constant in the model. And that's non-trivial because of the multiplicity. If you didn't have the multiplicity, the techniques used for well-known polygon models like self-avoiding polygons, you could use exactly the same idea to prove this exponential growth. But because of the multiplicity, it's actually much more complicated because you have to prove that the multiplicity is also bounded exponentially by the boundary length, and that's messy. It's okay, but it's possible eventually to do it. There is a power law behavior that I predicted in my 2024 paper, and that has now been confirmed by some explicit combinatorial using bijective methods by Budd and Zonneveld very recently. And there's also for the pure gravity model. So these are results for the pure gravity model where you don't couple any matter, CFT. You also have for the pure gravity a log correction to that scale. Maybe that will ring a bell for some of you. These logarithms are usually associated with the C equal one UVL. And here we have a sign that the C equal zero pure jetty gravity has some similarities with C equal one UVL. And it is actually true. And in particular, in the paper by Tim Budd, it's made very explicit, but also you will understand if we have time from what I said. And that nice picture here is taken from Tim Budd paper, so it's a typical, he made the simulation, it's a typical configuration. You see that the boundary is very rough, and indeed it will be a fractal. Typical boundaries in finite size GT will be fractals. Very good. Let me go fast on these slides. I just want to emphasize a crucial conceptual point. I explained that in holographic setup with asymptotic boundaries, the group of diffeomorphisms that you gauge are the ones that are small, so they don't act on the boundary. When you go to finite size, I claim that you always have to gauge both the small and the large diffeos. quantum gravity on finite size geometry should not depend on some arbitrary boundary coordinate system on the boundary. And when you discretize, when you have a discretized formulation, that's made explicit because the data, the combinatorial data in your discretizations do not encode any particular boundary coordinates. Okay, you only have metric data, both on the bulk and the boundary. So it's automatic if you have a discretized formulation. But that's very important conceptually, that if you go to finite volume, you have to gauge the large diffeos. All right. So how can we solve that model? I mean, so this I published already 2 years ago, and you know, people told me, but this is very, very difficult. It's nice, but it's very difficult. How are you going to deal with this super complicated problem? But then, okay, already in 2024, I had ideas how to do it, but now I'm going to explain you that actually you can sort of solve, at least conceptually, these constraints in a very beautiful way, okay? And the key point will be to go just to conformal gauge. So the key point is just to be old enough to be born in the period where conformal gauge was very important, knowing the, you know, all the Liouville story and string theory story, and realize that contrary maybe to the standard law, these techniques are completely relevant for JT gravity. And you can formulate JT gravity in this way. All right. The idea really, I think, in spirit is very similar to the SLE story. You know, the SLE story is such that, you know, in physics, when I was a student, SLE didn't exist, but we had very nice statistical physics courses explaining these beautiful, you know, physical things that are the Ising model interfaces or the percolation interfaces, etc. Very complicated, very mysterious objects. Then eventually the magic of SLE has been to realize that all these objects are particular instances of a process that is magically and beautifully related just to a Brownian process. And that's what makes it so simple in some sense. So these super non-Markovian things are actually related to a Brownian process. And then you, with the good parametrization, if you like, you start to really understand what's going on. For these self-overlapping configurations in JT, I think what I will present is the same sort of thing. It will not be a Wiener process. It will be related to a low-correlated Gaussian free field eventually. But that's the same idea. With the correct parametrization, things are very simple, even though the actual geometries that you want to describe look so complicated. So let me describe the result for the flat JT on the disk. So you go to conformal gauge, you can write your metric, as I said, as I just said here, and I just parameterize it with some Q because it's convenient, it will be convenient. Okay, for those who are familiar with Liouville, you recover some sort of Liouville convention here. So d squared is exponential 2 phi over q dz squared. Phi is the UV field or conformal factor that is parametrizing my metrics. Just in parentheses, I'm allowed to go to consider metrics of that form because I gauge the large diffeos. Okay, going to conformal gauge is possible if and only if you gauge the large diffeos. If you don't gauge the large diffeos, so the one that act non-trivial on the boundary, you cannot go to conformal gauge. Okay, so that's a very important thing to keep in mind. But since I did this, I'm allowed to do that. Now, for flat JT, the condition of flatness is just telling you that phi is a harmonic function. So it's super elementary. If you expand the boundary value of phi in Fourier mode, then the bulk value is just obtained by acting with the Poisson kernel, which in polar coordinate is a very elementary and a nice formula. Okay, so everything is actually encoded in the boundary conformal factor in JT. This is in sharp contrast with Liouville. In Liouville, boundary and bulk fluctuations are independent. In JT, the bulk fluctuations are completely encoded by the boundary fluctuations because of that constraint. That will also be true for the negative curvature model. Yeah. But here, I don't have time, so I use this flat now. Very good. Now, the measure on this boundary UV field will be written very explicitly in the way I just said. So in terms of the Fourier modes, you just have some Lebesgue piece, and then some action, which is the quadratic piece in the action is just governed by the Dirichlet to Neumann operator. So in Fourier mode, it's super simple. You know, it's just the sum of n absolute value squared of in squared, then plus q phi naught. Phi naught is the zero mode. This q phi naught term is crucial. The beauty of this formula is that it is a PSL2R invariant measure. And it has to, by consistency, because when you go to conformal gauge on the disk, of course, all the formalism has been invariant under the automorphisms of the disk. So this has to be a PSL2R invariant measure for reasons that are completely different from the PSL2R invariants of the Schwarzschild. Here, we are for the flat model. And this PSL2R would be present also in positive or negative curvature, but it's not related to isometric group of hyperbolic space. It's related to the fact that it's the automorphism group of the disk. In conformal gauge, you have that. So this simple measure you can check is PSL2R invariant. You have that term. You can add also a bulk cosmological constant term, and this is the magic term. So this S lambda, it's the integral of exponential 2 phi over q d to z. So let me emphasize that term, because that's really the fundamental new ingredient in JT. Curiously, it's never been considered before. It could have been considered also in the context of UVL. What are the features of that term? Exponential 2 phi over q is the area not renormalized. In UVL, you will have a renormalized operator, like some exponential gamma phi. Here, it's the classical guy, unrenormalized. Why am I allowed to do that? It's because in JT, the bulk is a smooth. Here, it's flat. This capital phi is just a harmonic function, completely smooth. So this operator is protected, if you like. It's unrenormalized. It's a marginal unprotected operator that you can add in your model. You could have added that in UVL as well by considering on the disk the harmonic extension of the boundary UVL and built that term and added it. Crazily enough, I don't think this has never been considered. People didn't realize that this term was a perfectly good marginal operator that you can add in UVL. And it's conformally invariant, it has all the properties.
So it doesn't exist on the closed space surface.
No, it doesn't exist on the closed surface, absolutely. It's only you need the bound, absolutely. But no, in JT, this guy is the geometric area, okay? So it's the physical area, the geometric area, and that's why you think about it, if you like, and you realize that you can write it this way. All right, what time is it?
23.
23. Okay, so I have 7-8 minutes.
Including questions.
Huh?
Including
questions. So I'll be fast. You know, I'll be fast. It's okay. I think I can do it. 5 minutes. So, all right. So, you know, I think I've shown enough to give you the flavor that, you know, all these old UVL techniques are not going to be imported in JT with some new flavor, with some similarities, but also some differences. The bulk is smooth, but the boundary is rough and it's fractal. So it will be the normal. Actually, the boundary guy is exactly as in UVL. So you'll have a renormalized boundary length beta, etc., etc. You can use KPZ arguments to compute, for example, the Hausdorff dimension of the boundary. So this is the formula. Nu is the inverse of the Hausdorff dimension, and C is the central charge of a CFT that you couple to JT, if you like. So C equal to zero is the pure JT. You see that C equals zero plays the role of C equal one in UV, something I had advertised quickly before. So pure JT is the case where the Hausdorff dimension is two and the parameter gamma equal to two. So it's the critical value for this log correlated field. Very, very good. And you can use this continuum formulation to draw some typical configurations. So that's the top picture. And you compare with what Tim got from his combinatorial. And I think that's pretty good. So this is for pure GT. Here, you have two other pictures. C equal minus. So when C goes to minus infinity, exactly as in UV, that's a semi-classical limit. And indeed, here there's a picture for typical configuration at C equal minus 125. You see that the boundary is smoother, much smoother than before. C equal 12 is in this very dangerous interval between 0 and 24, where everything explodes. Right? So it's like the interval between 1 and 25 in UV. You have some analog situation here, and it's some sort of exploding universe. I can analyze this picture, but I don't have time. Okay, now these are slides that were giving you more information on how you derive those results. I just want to mention that a crucial ingredient for the background independence of the model comes from the result by Colin Guillermoz and Laurent Guillaupé in 2007 on the properties of determinants of Dirichlet to Neumann operators. So I think it was quite nice. But that's not what I want. I don't want to finish on that. So I want just to finish. So, okay, here I presented sort of some sort of path integral presentation, but of course there is a CFT associated with that. So let me call it the JT CFT. And this JT CFT plays the role for JT as the UV CFT plays the role for UV quantum gravity. Okay? And this object exists. Here I have the action. The crucial insight is that this bizarre field phi, which is widely fluctuating on the boundary, but which is smooth in the bulk, can be written in terms of ordinary CFT objects just by writing phi equal psi plus chi, where psi is a normal Neumann-Coulomb gas scalar field, and chi is a time-like scalar field with Dirichlet boundary conditions. So psi plus chi is some sort of like a light-like direction in string theory. It's like an X plus. But with bizarre boundary conditions, the time-like piece chi has Dirichlet boundary conditions. And this particular combination is such that when you compute, let's say, the two-point function, the piece from Neumann in the bulk that is widely fluctuating will be canceled by the minus sign that comes from the time-like chi. And that's why phi is not zero, but is smooth in the bulk. So that's how you make link between this bizarre object and normal, let's say, scalar field in CFT. And you have an action with the term proportional to capital lambda is the guy I emphasized already a couple of minutes ago, this new area term, which is a smooth. But you have also for the curved model, so the term proportional to eta q, eta is plus one for the positive curvature model, minus one for negative, and zero for flat. So for the curved model, you also have this additional marginal guy. So that's another marginal operator proportional to chi and this exponential term that you have to add to go to the curved model. All right. Do I have 1 minute to conclude?
Yes.
Yeah? I'm alone? Okay. So let's do the last minute, some philosophical remark. You could say, okay, well, okay, so we have the infinite geometry picture that's a Schwarzschild. No, I try to convey the complications and interests to go to the finite geometry pictures of JT. So that's completely new. It is natural to ask, well, is the infinite geometry picture can be obtained by some limit of the finite size picture? And I think yes, but that's quite subtle. How could that work? So the idea, first of all, is that, okay, if you want to go to infinite geometries, you have to inflate, if you like, favor the large geometries. A simple way to do that is to turn on this bulk cosmological constant, lambda, and take lambda goes to minus infinity. Obviously, that will favor very large areas, because remember, lambda is the term in the action that is proportional to area. So if lambda is very large and negative, that favors very large geometries. So taking that limit probably is going to inflate my geometries. The beta s, I don't have time to explain how I get this formula, but this beta s of the Schwarzschild theory will be related to the microscopic parameters of the finite size theory in the way I indicated here. But what I just want to emphasize is that if it works, It has to be in a hydrodynamic way. It is clear that even if the geometry is super large, on distance scales that are of the order of the curvature length scale, you'll see the fractal structure. So if you zoom in, you will always see the fractal structure. However, the claim is that because of properties of hyperbolic space, when you have very large geometries, there will be a separation of scales. The geometry, the boundary will become much, 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 much longer than the curvature length scale. And you can imagine that on those very large length scales, the boundary is smoothed out. There's an average notion of smooth boundary. And maybe it wiggles smoothly and gently. And maybe the fluctuations of these large scale things is given by the Schwarzschild action. Okay, so that's the claim. And you know, you can present the conjecture very precisely because there is actually a very natural candidate for the emerging reparametrization mode. So you know, I think that's a super nice problem for both mathematicians and physicists. You can consider f of theta defined in that way. Okay, so that's a very rough object, that's a distribution object. Now, the claim is that in the limit I indicated before, the law of this guy will go to the Schwarzschild. So from very rough to very smooth. And that is how the reparametrization would emerge in that limit. If you think about it, it means, you know, that the reparametrization, which is the gravity mode, emerges. It means that there is a fundamental coordinate that emerges. And the gravity is described by this reparametrization of the fundamental coordinate. Here, the fundamental coordinate is just the angular coordinate that you have in conformal range. So that's emerging time, literally. You know, if what I've said is correct, you go to in a hydrodynamic way, you go from a model where you didn't have any privileged coordinate on the boundary to something that was described originally as a model where you didn't gauge the boundary reparametrization. So this boundary coordinate has to emerge in that picture. That's a model of emerging time, literally. And it tells you that, you know, this boundary gravity on very large distance scale is a smooth. It's hydrodynamic. It's given by hydrodynamics. And the TT bar, for those who know what it is, my claim is that all these TT bar approaches to finite geometry in holography, they are actually given not the microscopic theory, but this hydrodynamic guy. Okay. Yes, it's, yeah, that's Euclidean. But, you know, I think this story has also a real time picture. But yes, I understand things very well in the Euclidean. Absolutely. Okay, thank you very much for your attention.
Questions or comments for Frank?
Yes?
So the GTCFT that you mentioned, do you understand how it can be obtained from a limit of time-like equilibrium to space-like equilibrium?
No.
So
I don't think it's very similar, right?
So they're claiming a physics literature whereby combining time-like equilibrium and space-like equilibrium, the usual equilibrium, and the redefinition rescaling using the gamma parameter and taking gamma close to zero, you can obtain something like this.
No, because so what you're referring to is a formal limit where you reproduce the Schwarzschild field. This has nothing to do with this.
No, but there's a recent work actually does this directly in 2D, so in the ball. Where you combine the time-like equilibrium and space-like equilibrium, and you will see this kind of potential.
But you take gamma goes to zero.
That's right.
So that's a semi-classical, and that's that will be related to Schwarzschild-like physics.
Yes.
Here, it's supposed to be something much more general. The picture you're mentioning to is supposed to be a limit of that, probably the limit I've just described is hydrodynamic limit. But this is a much more general fundamental picture. Here, I'm saying this is describing any JT configuration of finite, including the finite size, for any curvature in an exact way.
And how would you say it's related to this finite gamma time-like equilibrium coupled to space-like equilibrium?
I don't know. I have never understood in any rigorous way even the link with the Schwarzschild. I think for me, this limit was always very formal. Indeed, you see, for example, you can match the Schwarzschild field theory correlators with the UV correlator that link. So that's very nice. Okay, actually, I think maybe the first derivation of the Schwarzschild field theory correlators were done via this sort of ansatz. But I don't think there is any deep understanding of why this is true. But anyway, this refers only to the Schwarzschild. So this is indeed sort of confusing because, yes, you've heard about sort of UV-like things in before for JT, but that has nothing to do with this. So this is really the finite size, finite cutoff story. And that's supposed to be an exact description, and that's derived from first principles because there is no ansatz here.
And you understand, for example, how to extract the static data?
How do
the static data, like structure constants?
Not at all. So, you know, this is completely new.
So it's very, it's not, I don't think it's fair to say that it's distinct from atomic nuclear plasma, space and critical, because there people understand how to cut.
No, I mean, I agree.
So they could still be related.
No, this CFT, you know, you have to study it. I mean, but it is a CFT. Now, the point I wanted to make is that the CFT tools work and now can be applied for JT with on finite size geometries. There will be a bootstrap, completely conformally invariant. You can use all your favorite tools of CFT to try to work out what it is. But it's completely new. Nothing is known. I hope simple things can be done easily now. So, yeah.
So sort of from the main question, in this slide you are saying that you found the time for all these competitions that you spend is multiplying the time. So yeah, okay, from the main.
Yes, okay, let me repeat it in a simple way. So the Schwarzschild field theory description is a normal holographic description for which, by definition, the coordinate on the boundary is fixed. Okay, so you do not gauge boundary reparametrizations. You don't have that in your mind. So you have a fundamental time, let's say, on the boundary. That's what I call the time, that's the coordinate on the boundary. That's, you know, in holography, that's what you have. So the boundary
is the boundary.
Time is the boundary coordinate that, here in our two-dimensional bulk model, the boundary is one-dimensional, so you just have. Now, the finite geometry picture is based on a completely different starting point. I consider finite size geometries, and I gauge large diffeomorphisms. So for the finite size geometries, there is no boundary coordinate that is privileged by definition of the model. Everything is built like, so at the microscopic level, you don't see those things at all. Now, the claim that has to be proven, it's a non-trivial claim, is that in the limit where I inflate my finite geometry picture, there will be a hydrodynamic mode that will govern the long wavelength fluctuations. I will no longer zoom in to see the fractal structure. I will remain at length scale much larger than the hyperbolic curvature length scale. And on those length scales, I say, okay, the boundary curve looks very smooth, and I will discover that the dynamics is governed by a mode which is a reparametrization. And eventually, in the limit, the claim is that it will match with the Schwarzschild theory. Schwarzschild theory, again, that was defined by having a fundamental time. So there's a fundamental Hamiltonian, if you like, in the Schwarzschild theory. Whereas the Hamiltonian finite volume at the microscopic level is zero. So if there is a limit that gives the Schwarzschild, it has to be a hydrodynamic kind of effective long wavelength object. And there will be. So the emerging Hamiltonian, hydrodynamic, and associated with its own notion of time. So that's the sense.
You think it's that's the implication for our universe and for reactive or just the one?
Yeah, I won't remain a little bit serious and rigorous. I will not make such. Okay, but it's a model for emerging time, for sure. And I don't know any other. Okay, so you know, well, I don't want to go beyond that. I think it's a cute thing to see how some Hamiltonian evolution can emerge starting from a model that doesn't have such a thing.
Yeah. It's a nice question from an audience. If I remember correctly, It's okay. It's a leak. There is a good idea to have the half of the group of the four over the half of 16, after which 200 are linked to one of the index that are very good. The room for anything like that in the theory of studying the symmetry gamma goes to 400 gamma.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's this symmetry is also present in UV, but it's not really symmetry yet. So, in the same way as in UV, you have such a thing and you have it here, but it's not really symmetry.
That's why it's here.
Maybe a duality, but I don't think it's really a duality. As far as I understand, for example, you know, the area operator, I'm talking about UV, the area operator, like is an exponential gamma phi, and you have another operator where gamma goes to 4 over gamma that has the same dimension. As far as I understand, my probabilist friends told me that only one of these guys can make sense of it, and the other guy, not really. So I don't think there is really an exact duality between the two objects.
For SLE, each one makes
sense. Yes, for SLE, yes, but not for UV, as far as I understand. Yes, but
in your case, yeah, you don't have the gamma information.
Yes, because Q is also related to gamma in the usual way. So Q is 2 over gamma with gamma over. So you will find, you know, just from that, but that. At least at my level of understanding, there is nothing deep I can say about this. That's something to keep in mind, maybe, but I, you know, I don't know.
More questions? But
not this time, frankly.
This only had 11.